This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
My view on carbon capture and storage is that it's an essential technology for humanity to develop in order to crack the climate change problem.
Is living sustainably a plausible proposition? That's the crucial question today's first guest on Sea Change Radio, David Mackay, is trying to answer. Mackay, the chief scientific advisor to the Department of Energy and Climate Change in Great Britain and the author of the seminal work Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, is one of the most important figures in the environmental policy field. A physicist and information theorist, Mackay is a master of breaking down the numbers for us all to better assess the planet's renewable energy options. We discuss his pro-nuclear stance and his advocacy for the development of carbon capture and storage technology, which remains unpopular in many environmental circles. Next, I speak with Mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies, who has advanced environmental policy in his own way. The small town recently passed an ordinance requiring all new homes to be solar equipped. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Mackay. He's the chief scientist at the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK and a professor in the engineering department at the University of Cambridge. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. First, can you describe your journey to your present position at the Department of Energy and Climate Change and explain the department's mission, if you can?
Yes, I'm a physicist and I'm also an engineer, and I've been teaching physics in the University of Cambridge for about 20 years now. And my specialism wasn't in energy issues, and I'm an energy amateur, but as a physics teacher, I would be teaching energy on a regular basis. I became frustrated with what I was hearing in the media, the things I heard on the radio, the way people talked about climate change and energy, and the terrible polarized conversations that were going on with people being anti-wind or anti-nuclear and all fighting with each other. And it felt to me that there wasn't enough discussion of facts and of numbers, and that there was a real need for numeracy in the public discussion of energy options. So I decided to write a book aimed at the general public to try and help people understand energy arithmetic. So I wrote a book and I gave it away free online. It's called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. And I got a publisher who was happy to publish it on paper as well. So you can buy it from Amazon and other places too. And that book was just a factual, honest book trying to help people have honest conversations based on real numbers. And so I describe all forms of energy consumption and all possible forms of energy production, especially the climate-friendly, low-carbon forms of energy production for the future. And this book went down extremely well. It got cross-party support, including the right wing and the left wing and the Greens and the pro-nuclear and the fossil fuel industry. And so I'm delighted with that. And I was asked to apply for this job here as a senior civil servant in London. And so 3.5 years ago, I became chief scientific advisor to the Department of Energy and Climate Change, which is the department charged with keeping the lights on in Britain and also making sure that we take climate change action. So here we're really trying to grapple with the tension between everyone's demand for energy and also our desire to save the planet, if you like.
So the Department of Energy and Climate Change, we don't have something like that here in the U.S. And we have a Department of Energy and we have an EPA, an Environmental Protection Agency. How is it set up in Great Britain?
Yes, it used to be similar in Britain. I think we had the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs taking the environmental protection role, and we had a business and enterprise and trade and industry department. And there was perhaps tension between the objectives of those departments. And it was a brilliant move of the last government, I think, to put the two issues together and have a single department that was in charge of both these objectives. And I think it's working extremely well. Initially, people talked of the two decks as if they were in conflict with each other, but people don't have that perception anymore. We really do have a single mission of powering the country and protecting the planet.
And a lot of the ideas that you set forth in your book, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, it's this very clear-eyed vision of tomorrow. I'd like to dive into it. You look at what you call your energy balance sheet, or not just Britain's, but the planet's energy balance sheet. And then you ask, can we conceivably live sustainably? While you were researching this and coming up with the different angles, what kind of conclusions did you draw? Can we live sustainably?
Well, it depends what country you live in and how much land you have, and it depends which sources of energy you're willing to get your sustainable energy from, and it depends on what sort of lifestyle you want to have. And I think what my book shows is that there is quite a lot of wishful thinking. People think it's possible to live like kings, but still be anti-everything and say, oh, I don't want nuclear power and I don't want wind farms. And maybe there are particular technologies that people are happy with. So, you know, some people will say, oh, I do like wind farms. I just want wind farms, and I want to continue living like a king at today's standard of living. And what my book shows is that sort of belief that we can have today's lifestyle and live solely on renewables, that doesn't actually quite stack up in a country like the UK, because there just isn't realistically enough land area. Or if you really did want that vision, then you have to expect a substantial fraction of our land area to be occupied by renewable facilities like solar panels and wind farms and so forth. And if you're lucky to live in a large country, then the total number of solar panels and wind turbines needed remains just the same per person, but they'd be less intrusive in the landscape because there is more land area per person in the USA. If you're happy to include in your portfolio other technologies like carbon capture and storage and nuclear power as well, then the answer is yes, you can make plans that add up using those and renewables, and especially if you invest in energy efficiency and you say, okay, let's transform the technologies we use, let's change to more efficient technologies, lighter weight vehicles, electric vehicles, homes that are better insulated, that make better use of natural daylight and so forth. And let's buy less stuff and throw away less stuff. Or let's go vegetarian, because vegetarianism has a lower energy footprint. These are all caricatures and extremes. The message of my book is that if you do take action on the demand side and on the supply side, it's possible to make plans that add up, but the scale of action required is probably more than people have been led to believe. I've reworked the numbers for the USA. My book looks at the UK as an example, but it's quite easy to translate to the USA. And the sort of scale of action that's required just to look after American electricity alone at today's level. Today in the USA, electricity consumption is about 40 kilowatt hours per day per person. And of course, on top of electricity, we have to also think about transport and heating and powering industry, which maybe give you at least a fourfold increase in total energy demand. But just looking at the electricity side of things, if you wanted to get roughly 40 kilowatt hours per day for a single person from solar power, that person requires 80 square meters of solar panels, would be one way of delivering it.
Wow.
And so that's imaginable. But yeah, not everyone has a backyard that's 80 square meters inside. But that on average would give you 40 kilowatt hours a day of electricity. You can get about 40 kilowatt hours per day per person from wind if every 300 people invest in one standard 2 megawatt turbine, one big wind turbine. You can get 42 kilowatt hours per day per person from nuclear power if you had a fivefold increase in nuclear power for the USA, which means that every city the size of Denver or Boston or Las Vegas or Portland would have its own 1 gigawatt nuclear power station. So those are some example options at the corners, if you like, of a solar panel solution, a wind solution, a nuclear solution to deliver today's electricity. And then if you bear in mind that you've also got to deal with your heating demand for space heating, in at least in the cold parts, but that need heating in the winter, and the demand for transport. Current consumption of liquid fuel for transport in America is about 100 kilowatt hours per day per person. You could make that more efficient with lighter vehicles, and you could maybe electrify them. To deal with each of these areas, heating and industry and transport, you maybe need a ballpark another 40 kilowatt hours per day per person for those as well. So the scale of action required to get us off fossil fuels is really quite enormous. And we're unaware of the immense fossil fuel infrastructure that is supplying our lifestyle today.
So just to recap some of the both the supply and the demand sides. On supply, you're looking at the options as being renewables, nuclear power, and clean coal, CCS. But then on the demand side, you're looking at electrifying transport, heat pumps, and green electricity. And also, at the same time, you're doing a lot in your role to raise awareness about conservation and efficiency. But where does that factor into your supply and demand calculations? Where does conservation and efficiency cross those supply and demand factors?
You're right to identify those as the big fish, the big levers we can really push. There's nuclear power with a good track record of producing low carbon electricity. Carbon capture and storage is a possible way of generating power that isn't really proven at scale yet. There's a whole bunch of renewable technologies that work just fine, like wind power, though it's intermittent, and solar power, though you get more from it in Arizona than in a place like London. So those are on the supply side, and on the demand side. There are many ways of reducing demand. Industry itself could be more efficient. We could have more reuse. We could design things to last for longer, so that when we make a steel girder and put it in a building, that girder is used in that building for longer, and then it's reused in another building. We can make vehicles lighter. That reduces the energy cost of making the vehicles, and it reduces the energy cost of running vehicles. We could have enhanced use of public transport. So these are all the options. And I see my role is not really advocating any particular mix of those options, but just advocating we must talk in terms of numbers, and we need to have a plan that adds up and that is consistent with itself.
So how does conservation and efficiency kind of factor into those variables?
Well, let me give you some examples of conservation efficiency. Obviously, make stuff last twice as long, then we'll need to buy half as much stuff, so that will halve the energy cost of our industry. Another example is on transport. A standard vehicle uses 80 kilowatt hours of liquid fuel to take you 100 kilometers. And electric vehicles are about four times more efficient. They use about 20 kilowatt hours of electricity per 100 kilometers. Or you could ride a bicycle, and then you're only going to need about 1 kilowatt hour per 100 kilometers. So you can get massive energy savings by switching to lighter vehicles, vehicles with more efficient energy transmissions, or actually going for a lifestyle change, which is the most extreme form of conservation, where you say, I'm going to mainly ride a bicycle and use public transport.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with David Mackay. He's the Chief Scientific Advisor for the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK. The US, Australia, and Canada use about twice as much energy per person as in the UK. How much of that can be attributed to transportation in your estimation? These are much larger countries, obviously, in terms of square footage than the UK. Is that our lifestyle, or is it really boiled down to transport?
Yes, when you compare America with Europe, everything pretty much seems to be doubled. So our buildings use about half as much energy as American buildings, even though our average temperatures are fairly similar. Our transport system uses about half as much. And I think that's largely driven by the fact that American vehicles are heavier. But it is true that you might drive it further as well because of the lifestyle difference and the average population density of some of your cities being much larger, so people commute larger distances. So yes, everything's roughly doubled, and Europe is an existence proof. It shows that it is possible to have actually a fairly acceptable lifestyle and use about half as much energy as Americans are using.
So you had mentioned nuclear power, and your book was written before Fukushima. Since that disaster unfurled, has your thinking at all changed in terms of nuclear power as a future solution?
No, it hasn't changed really. What I'd say about nuclear power is every technology does have risks and costs and uncertainties, and climate change is a severe threat, and coal power itself is actually a larger source of radiation than nuclear power stations, and it has direct health disbenefits as well. The pollution from coal power stations is significant. And it's okay to be anti-nuclear as long as you do have a plan that adds up and that you understand the scale of what's required to deliver the energy that people are demanding.
And that's where I'm a little bit wary of carbon capture and storage. It sounds like a terrific solution if it's possible. But here in the U.S., at least, we have this enormous reliance on coal, and coal is an important lobby in trying to actuate policy change. And so because of this pie-in-the-sky solution that still is not affordable and has not been proven to be scalable, I'm afraid that CCS and discussions of that will actually just continue to keep coal in its current form moving along. And I think that's kind of the strategy of the American coal companies, at least. How do you see it?
I understand what you're saying. My view on carbon capture and storage is that it's an essential technology for humanity to develop in order to crack the climate change problem. As you said, the world has plenty of cheap coal, and so it's very credible that people will have the urge to go ahead and burn it. And so we need to develop a technology that allows us at low cost to use that coal and use it in a climate safe way. So I think carbon capture and storage is essential. It's certainly not proven at large scale. North America is one of the best places for carbon capture and storage because it's currently being used at power stations to generate CO2 that's used for enhanced oil recovery. So North America has done the world a great favor by demonstrating that chain of carbon capture and insertion into geology. I think it's a crucial technology to develop. I recognize your concern that we might just go halfway. The bottom line is it's only going to happen if we do put a price on carbon, because obviously burying the CO2 will have an extra cost compared with just releasing it into the atmosphere. So we have to price carbon, and that's one of the most important messages, I think, that the only way you will get successful climate change action is if society puts a price on carbon emissions.
So you believe that CCS, carbon capture and storage, and pricing carbon appropriately go hand in hand?
Yes, CCS won't happen without a carbon price. I do think we need a carbon price, and we need CCS for the world as a whole. Individual countries will be able to get by fine without carbon capture and storage, but the world as a whole is going to need it.
The Chief Scientific Advisor for the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK, David Mackay. David, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Kies. He is the Mayor of Sebastopol, California, and a retired energy consultant. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So Sebastopol is a small town north of San Francisco, and it was just in the news because you recently passed an ordinance regarding new homes and solar panels. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about it?
It actually is all new buildings, and we now have a requirement that new buildings install solar panels. And the overall concept is that these buildings install enough solar so that they don't generate any greenhouse gases.
And walk us through the evolution of the legislation.
Sebastopol has a history of interest in photovoltaic solar. And in 2002, we actually had a group of Sonoma State students do a survey of all the rooftops in Sebastopol and how many were reasonable, had reasonable solar access. Sebastopol itself, virtually every municipal building has solar on it. The swimming pool, the police department, the fire department, city hall, the community center, all have solar. And on a per capita basis, we have the highest solar penetration in the nation, or very close to it.
And what do you attribute that to? Mostly legislation or just a very solar-friendly community?
Up until now, we actually haven't had any legislation requiring it. But we've been very active in promoting solar, that the city formed an organization called Solar Sebastopol that promoted solar. We've had a couple solar fairs, energy efficiency fairs. We had gotten a couple grants from the state. The second one actually formed Solar Sonoma County, which is a countywide version of what Solar Sebastopol was. And it does a lot of trainings for installers, building inspectors. In Sebastopol, solar is very typical. I think we probably have 300 installations now, which is probably somewhere close to 10% of the buildings. Well, we have 1.2 megawatts of solar installed. That's probably about 20% of our peak power demand. It's fairly significant. I think that it demonstrates that solar really is a viable option, not necessarily to power all your power, but to supply all the peak power that's required.
So critics might look at this ordinance and say, well, why should a town be telling me what I can and cannot put on my house? And this is a rich person's law. How do you respond to that kind of criticism of mandatory solar on new home legislation?
Well,
like
we really only had one person who spoke up saying the ordinance ought to be voluntary, and installing solar on your house is already voluntary. That it's like the state has lots of energy legislation. Back in 1978, when Title 24 was first enacted, it required insulation in buildings. And, you know, a lot of people complained, why should I have insulation in buildings? And then they required double pane windows. This is just part of the evolution of making buildings energy independent.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies. Sebastopol, California is a pretty liberal town, correct?
Yeah, very progressive.
a sister town to the south, Lancaster, California, which is a right-wing leaning town politically.
They're not really a sister. They're more like a cousin when it comes to solar.
But they did pass something similar.
They passed the ordinance, and what it really shows is that it's not a political issue, that it's a social issue, that everybody recognizes that climate change is a problem and we need to deal with it. And the liberals can deal with it, and the conservatives can deal with the same solutions.
So in terms of the details of the ordinance, do they have to provide for as much as of their electricity by solar? What are kind of the minimums besides just having quote-unquote solar on their house?
Well, there's two methodologies for installing solar. One is a prescriptive method that requires 2 watts per square foot of conditioned building space. And the other is a calculated method, a performance method that requires that you produce 75% of the building's estimated power demands. And it's really actually very simple. I mean, the ordinance itself is very simple. It you have your option of doing either. And for residential buildings that you already have to calculate your energy use for Title 24 to calculate the solar system size, you go online and spend 5 minutes. So it's really a very simple calculation added on to what you already have to do. For commercial, there's going to be times when the 2 watts per square foot it makes more sense. Because there's obviously, like if you have a warehouse, you don't need 2 watts per square foot. But if you have a restaurant, you might need 10 watts per square foot, and it just won't fit on the roof. So we have options for trying to make it as flexible as possible.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies. Michael, would an ordinance like this work for a middle or lower income town, unlike Sebastopol, which is a fairly upscale town? How would it break down financially for public housing, for example?
Actually, in Sebastopol, we have quite a bit of low income housing. That we're way over our required quotas from ABAG. And almost all of the new low-income housing in Sebastopol does have solar on it. It's subsidized through the state. The city actually has a fund for low-income housing that the city would help with if there are issues building low-income housing and adding solar. It hasn't been a problem before. And for any kind of market rate housing, when you're adding it into the cost of the overall mortgage, maybe you're looking at an extra $50 a month. But when you're looking at your energy costs, you're saving $150 a month. So it's actually quite a good deal.
And if somebody is listening who is a involved citizen in their community, or a mayor, an alderman, what kind of advice would you give to them to try to move this legislation forward in their community?
Well, I mean, it was really simple for us. I don't know. It seemed like it was simple for Lancaster. So maybe it's those middle of the road communities that are going to have problems. They're welcome to look at our ordinance. It should be on our website shortly. Because it's quite simple. It's only 2 pages long. Doesn't interfere with any of the state energy mandates. And they just need to convince the builders and developers within their area that it's going to be good for their business.
The mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies. Michael, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio.
Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jerry Garcia, The Clash, and Little Village.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.